The missing capability here is not patient engagement, it's patient agency. And that's why I think products like GPT Health is very exciting. It has the potential to shift power from the health systems to patients.
Hopefully that energy and excitement from a lay public will help force the health systems to think about the biggest users of the EHR, which are actual patients.
Welcome to The Other 80. I'm Claudia Williams. I'm going to say something that may sound a little provocative. The fastest adopters of AI in healthcare may not be health systems or health plans or even doctors. It may be patients. Not because they're reckless, not because they distrust clinicians, but because when you're sick or scared or trying to help someone you love, you just can't wait. For years, healthcare has operated with an implicit hierarchy. Expertise at the top and compliance at the bottom. But AI is inviting us to move to a new model that is grounded in shared information and agency. In this episode, I sit down with legendary patient innovators Hugo Campos and Liz Salmi, and we dive into these questions together. Both have spent decades fighting for patient access to their own data. Hugo tried for years to access the data collected by his own implantable cardiac device. And Liz, a brain cancer patient, has been a leader in the Open Notes movement. So please welcome Hugo Campos and Liz Salmi to The Other 80.
Before we begin, and I'll be introducing you in the show notes with your bios, but I think one of the places where the three of us met together and got to know each other was through an amazing conference community called Medicine X. And I want to just start with a question. What was magical about that community?
I think what was successful or what was special about it was the fact that it was such a diverse group of individuals in a sense of different ideas, different backgrounds, folks with very different perspectives. Researchers were there and entrepreneurs and clinicians, patients, and they're all sort of in equal footing. Dr. Larry Chu, who started the company, just created this really fantastic place where people felt really comfortable and to share their ideas and share their thoughts and advance a new thinking in the space of healthcare. I don't know exactly what the secret sauce was for it, but I think it was at the right place at the right time. It's just a good all-around experience, I think, for all of us.
As a person living with brain cancer, a patient advocate who applied to present at Medicine X, like there was an opportunity for patient voices to be highlighted on the stage. And so for people who are clinicians, researchers, technologists in industry, they went to that conference because they knew patients were also there. And that's was the secret sauce. And we were, as patients, assigned mentors to help us tell those stories. Because often, you know, as a patient, I don't know how to tell my story at first. And my speaking mentor was Hugo Campos, who is here with us today. So this now celebrates like a decade of friendship at this moment in time. And a lot of the patients who participated in that program are like super rock star leaders today. And I'm not talking about myself necessarily, but there are so many people who went through Medicine X in all of the different years. And we all learned a lot. And it was an education for us. And it was a free education.
I think to your point, it had this amazing combination of edginess and this perception that collaborations would and could form from it, but also incredible production. I just remember the makeup counter for the speakers and the photos and the voice of God coming out. And so just was super fun, you know, where the lights would go down and you'd say, what mystery is coming my way next? Okay, I asked the two of you to speak at the end of last year, and in the interim, since we've been waiting to have a conversation, there's been a lot of developments, including the release by ChatGPT of a new health product for consumers. And I don't think there's been another time in my decades of experience in health and health policy where I have seen so much activity on LinkedIn. I scrolled through this morning. I was up, unfortunately, at 4:30 a.m. And I was like, let's take a look at what people are saying. I want to use some of those comments and viewpoints as a lens into what's going on right now around AI capabilities. So I'm going to read the comments, and then I'm going to ask each of you to give your thoughts on the release of this new product, but also to make any reflections you want on the comments themselves. All right, so here goes. As AI tools become increasingly embedded in healthcare, literacy becomes just as important as the technology itself, AI literacy. This is very exciting and a little scary, a huge step forward for patients. But will this be used ethically, and how will it be made available to all? Now, the real test isn't scale. It's whether these systems can move beyond reassurance to real interpretation and better decisions. Once people experience context-aware answers on demand, tolerance for disjointed care collapses. Health systems won't be competing with AI. They'll be competing with the expectations AI creates. When patients bring this level of information and preparation to visits, it allows healthcare professionals to move beyond data entry and focus on values, trade-offs, and shared decision-making. And on the other hand, people said this can materially increase provider burden and liability. So lots to unpack there with these comments, but I wanted to now turn to each of you. Hugo, you first, with your short thoughts on this release, and then any comments you want to make about these ideas that were shared on LinkedIn.
Thank you for reading it. There's definitely a lot to unpack. This, to me, is incredibly exciting because it shifts some of the responsibility and the power and responsibility. These things come together, even though it seems like folks have forgotten that when we look around the world these days, it seems like not everyone realizes that power and responsibility are really tied at the hip, and we should be responsible with the power we have. But I think this is important for patients to realize that with that, it comes the need for us to better understand our health, to better know where to go to get our health information and how to apply it how to apply these tools in a responsible way for advancing our goals and our preferences as patients, taking perhaps even some of the burden off of the health systems. I'm very optimistic about it. I don't see it as in a negative light in any way.
So I'll plus one to what Hugo just said. And then what I'd add to it is I also applied for the early release of GPT Health and got the invite last night. This morning, I was like, let me start up. I have tons of medical records. And I also, like Hugo, started uploading the medical records and then started to validate it and asking it to do a qualitative analysis of my health records. And it makes me think of the Dr. Google era of when clinicians were like, patients shouldn't go online and look for information about their own health because they don't know how to search accurately for their own health information. And I think we're at like this early stage of the tension between health systems wanting to still control how patients find their own health information versus our own curiosity and exploration of digging into our own health information and asking the questions that are important to us and then discovering the answers ourselves in our own journey. It's a brand new release. It's hours old, I think, to both Hugo and I. So I'm really curious to see like what the regular person is going to start experiencing with this. And do they trust it?
I had that thought about, are there going to be bifurcations? And I was really interested. My dad had cancer treatment last year. He's doing fine now. He had a lot, as is often the case, a lot of complicated care, lots of different providers in the mix, and was getting these lab results and just couldn't figure out what questions to ask his doctor. And I said, let's just take a picture of the lab results and upload it to ChatGPT. And he looked, and he was a patent lawyer, so dealt a lot with innovation and technology and healthcare. He literally said, oh my gosh, when he looked at it. And it was great because it didn't just say, here's what these results mean, but it weighed out 10 follow-up questions he might want to ask his doctor about the results, about his care. And my dad said he went into his UPenn doctor and had the conversation. And he's 94. So I don't know. I think especially if this is easy to use and it's easy to get your results, I think people will use it differently. And I bet you two will be coding and doing all kinds of stuff like that. But just to understand what is often a fragmented and complicated information set for each of us, it's amazing. I will reveal, I didn't actually keep track of who said what, but the comment about this is going to change expectations of health systems. In other words, it's going to make people realize that continuous wraparound real-time care could be a thing. That was from Kaiser, from a Kaiser executive who focuses on AI. I'm curious what you think about that comment in particular.
Yeah, it's funny. It seems like the health systems want patients to be literate enough to comply, but not empowered enough to resist. In the paper that Liz and I wrote on critical AI health literacy, we make a very clear distinction between institutional AI and patient-directed AI or patient-driven AI. And by that, we mean that the AI deployed by the health systems will always do the work of the health systems, for the health systems, within the constraints of the health systems, of all the constraints that they have, including from their procurement needs and their profit margins, all the way to their legal constraints and all of the things that patients who are suffering or seeking relief from their pain or extending their lives or who have received, God forbid, a life-threatening diagnosis and are very scared are not really bound by these constraints. And this is where the empowerment comes in. And that's why I think products like GPT Health is very exciting. It's because it has the potential to shift some of that power from the health systems to the hands of patients. Conflict is not necessarily a bad thing. It only means that it's an opportunity for a discussion. It's an opportunity for learning. It's if you look at it in a positive light, it can be an opportunity for growth for both parties.
As a person living with a serious condition, brain cancer, to me, it's all about, I'm curious about my own health. And transparency is really important to me. Me having access to the information in my own health records is super important. I love to dig through that. I discover things when I read things like my notes and look at my test results. And unfortunately, the patient portal platforms that are available to patients today only show you parts, and you really have to go into bits and pieces of your patient portals to find the things that you're looking for. I know Epic has recently started creating some sort of things for patients to actually query their own health records through an AI platform, but they're creating tools that will help the hospitals and health systems as opposed to specifically the patients. Those things are not co-designed with patients. So for me, I've already created GPTs of my entire medical record. I have my own custom GPT in ChatGPT. I'm not a plant from OpenAI, but to be able to create my own GPT of all of my health records makes it possible for me to query everything in my own record and prompt it and like learn more about my own health. So that way I can ask better questions when I go back to my doctor's visits. And it's unfortunate that health systems haven't already created these tools for patients because we're already using them in these other spaces. And so I think hopefully the fact that there's so much excitement about tools like this, and I'm sure other generative AI companies will start doing something similar. Hopefully that energy and excitement from a lay public will help force the health systems and the electronic medical record vendors to think about the biggest users of the EHR, which are actual patients.
What's missing here is the last 10 or 20 years, we've focused on patient engagement. But the missing capability here is not patient engagement. It's patient agency. And this is really, I think, what these tools are unlocking is finally the ability for patients to have agency, which is, I think, what we need.
Let me ask a question and bring it back to that point about agency, which I think is so important. What I'm noticing as an underbelly of a lot of the comments is this feeling like it's a zero-sum game, that if patients have power, clinicians will have less power. I feel like there's a different possible framing that is not zero-sum, that is not about there's 100 points of power and 50, you know, if 10 more go to patients, 10 fewer go to providers. How do we help frame this out for clinicians in a way that helps them understand a potential role going forward without feeling a loss for themselves?
What clinicians are feeling really threatened is by the implementation of AI by their institutions. The patient doesn't represent any threat. Their loss of autonomy has been happening over the last decade or so. And that's, I think, in part why folks are burning out and physicians are not happy in their jobs. My hope is for AI is that it will serve as a bridge to rescue the relationship between doctor and patient and not further break that. That's how I look at it. It's like, how might we use AI to better collaborate, to work together, so that the patient can take on some of the effort that the doctor has to put into their daily job and do some of that work, because it matters to me as a patient, not because I'm trying to do my doctor's job, it's because it's important to me. I have skin in the game. But also, I want to make sure that my doctor is doing the best they can with the limited resources they have, with the limited amount of time they have, with the constraints that the institution has put on their life and on their practice of medicine. So how can I help alleviate that? And in the end, have a better outcome that is better for me and that results in a better, healthier, happier doctor, because a happy doctor is a good doctor for me.
Is there an example you can think of from one of your clinical relationships with a provider where that's happening, where the AI has helped create agency, where it's created room for collaboration?
There's been three instances in my care and the care of my dad, who lives with us and is 95, where we used AI in our care to understand a diagnosis or to find a solution or to even find a diagnosis. So, and with three different outcomes. In one situation where he needed to see a specialist and it was too far away, it was 4 months away, we had to wait and he was suffering. So we used AI successfully to find an interim solution for the problem while we waited for the appointment. It turned out that the AI correctly diagnosed his condition, as I would find out when we finally saw the specialist. And so it provided good advice that we followed and was successful. Very good outcome in that regard. There was another situation in which I used AI to help me advocate for a specific type of treatment. That was not successful. The outcome was not in my favor. So that was an unsuccessful use of AI. It was not helpful to me. And there was a third instance when I was diagnosed with hyperthyroidism, and I created a Claude artifact to help me think through the diagnosis. And help, it was everything was entirely new to me in that space. I didn't really know a whole lot about it. The conclusion that I got to by using these AIs was slightly different than what the doctor had come up with. I was afraid to mention to the doctor that I had no relationship with and had just met that I had been using AI. I didn't want to say that to her because I didn't want her to prejudge me. In the end, I actually shared the artifact with her, and she was excited about it. She says, "Oh my God, my husband works with AI, and he's going to love to play with this. This is really interesting. This is amazing." So it gave me hope, because it said we can bridge this, because the doctor is using AI. You know, why shouldn't the patient use AI as well? And we all should use these tools in order to alleviate each other's burden. It's just another tool. In the same way, were we threatened by computers when computers came out, Lord know how long ago, 50, 60 years ago, folks were threatened. And, you know, the Industrial Revolution, the printing press threatened folks. So it's like, it's just another step in human evolution. We just have to approach it with our eyes wide open, responsibly, and bravely, as we have in the past history of mankind, or of humankind.
No notes.
I actually want to go back to some of the history, both your personal history and also the history of this movement. I think it helps elucidate the point you just made, Hugo, which is we have these cycles and we go through fear cycles and innovation cycles. So Open Notes is a movement for doctors and the health systems that they're part of to share the actual underlying clinical notes, so the description the doctor writes about what's going on with patients. So Liz, talk a little bit about Open Notes. What happened when it was first rolled out? What's been the effect over time? And what would you say has been the deeper impact of this change?
So for folks who aren't aware about Open Notes, you can go to opennotes.org, and that's where our research lab website is about. It started with a study that was published in Annals Internal Medicine, three-site study, where doctors and researchers wanted to know what happens if you actually shared openly and transparently the notes that doctors are writing. And by the way, for folks who aren't aware of this, if you go into a patient portal today, you can go ahead and read your doctor's notes. And it took the 21st Century Cures Act to make it so that patients have easy access to the notes. But going back to the original studies in 2007, 2008, the idea was patients couldn't see what was in their medical records. And so they did a study, three different health systems around the country, different settings, and said, for a year, let's share the doctor's notes with patients. They did a pre-survey before starting the study and asked doctors, what do you think will happen if we share your notes with patients? And they said, well, our inbox basket's going to explode and patients won't understand where we're writing. They don't know these acronyms. They don't know these words. We love our patients, but it's going to create a lot of work for us. And then they also surveyed the 20,000 patients who would be enrolled in the studies, and those who responded said, you know, like, what do you think will happen when we start sharing our notes with you? And the patients are like, I don't know, because I've never seen our notes. So it was really hard for them to respond to that survey. Like, how could they predict what they would see? A year goes by, and during that year, they would check in with the doctor and said, how is it going? Are you hearing from your patients? And they're like, we haven't been hearing anything, but the few of us who have heard something, the messages we're getting is, hey, I really like that thing you sent to me. It was fun to hear your reasoning after the fact. Actually, I noticed an error in there. You might want to fix it. And so good things are happening during the course of the study. Jumping ahead, at the end of the study, essentially, the output was patients loved reading their notes. Doctors felt like it was great to get that feedback from their patients that they were really listening. And 98% of the patients involved in the study loved the idea of being able to read what their doctors are writing. You can't get like 98% of people agree on anything. And so, you know, that kicked off this movement of, well, let's continue to research this idea and let's continue to just share notes with patients. And so about 15% of the US population or patients or like health systems just started to share the notes, and it wasn't mandated. It was like they voluntarily thought this was a great idea. And so then at the same time in parallel, and now I'm talking about public policy, but in parallel, the 21st Century Cures Act was going on, where legislation was happening that said, soon health systems, you must share everything with patients. So we get to 2021, I think it was, where suddenly this legislation went into law, and now everyone around the United States had access to their health information, which was something new for patients. Like, suddenly we all could see, not just those at those select sites around the country, but everyone could see what was in their medical records.
People think of HIPAA as being about protecting and the privacy of health records. A big part of HIPAA was establishing and confirming the right of patients to have access to their own health information. That was that law, the law and the regulations were written before we had digital health information. So a lot of these updates, including 21st Century Cures, including the High Tech Act, have been taking that original premise and bringing it in to the digital age by saying, okay, you should have access to your digital information. 30 days isn't the right amount of time to give you access if it's available immediately on the record. We should be able to have access not just to the data, but to the FHIR APIs that would allow us to bring that data into the apps of our own choosing. And as someone that was, you know, working on those things, working with patients, working with regulators, working with industry, we were often told, that's all great, but that's kind of hypothetical. And we saw Google Health, we saw Microsoft Health Vault, we saw Apple's efforts to do PHRs. And truly, for the most part, they were uphill slogs that most of them ended up closing. And I think it was because access to the data is great. And for some people, that's enough. But we want to be able to interact with it. We want to be able to ask questions of it. We want to be able to quickly find it, the needle in the haystack when we're looking. We want to be able to ask whether there are clinical trials that map to our diagnosis. We want to ask what diagnoses might be possible. So I feel like this is such an important moment because it's the moment this release was built on those policies. This release was built on the HIPAA policies, on the FHIR APIs being available, and really for this vision of what would be possible. And finally, we're starting to see that vision. So I just want to applaud all of the patients that pushed so hard for these policies, all of industry that saw what was possible. And we just happened to be at this virtuous moment in history where the groundwork that was laid is now manifesting in these possibilities. If those FHIR APIs were not there, what it was going to take to upload your records was literally taking photos of all the PDFs. Hugo, you would not be talking about, I uploaded all my records last night or this morning, because you probably have boxes, and you too, Liz, have boxes and boxes if you made it into paper. So it's important to see that long history trajectory of what we've been trying to build. And I want to use that, Hugo, to also go back to your experience with your heart device and the struggle that you've been through. But I just think this is such an exciting moment as a former policymaker to see what's possible today because of those important policy changes. Thank you for bringing that up, Liz. Okay, Hugo, when I first met you, you had quite a bit of media coverage. And what was happening was you have a cardiac condition and you have an implantable device in your body. And what you wanted as the incredibly curious person you are and somebody who really cares about your health is you wanted access to your data. Tell us the story of that, I will call it a struggle, of that struggle you've had over the last, when do we meet? More than 10 years ago, 20 years, over the last 20 years to get access to your data.
Yeah. When I received an implantable defibrillator, I received one of the first devices that were capable or equipped with wireless telemetry, the ability to transmit data through a radio transmitter to a bedside monitor. And that was back in 2007. And it was one of the first devices that were out. And the doctor was excited about it. And he says, oh, this is really interesting. This is great. You're going to get one of those new devices. I was very excited as well. And I said, what is the URL for the patient portal for that? And the doctor was puzzled. And it was like, no, it's not for you. It's for us. And I said, well, how does that make sense? Aren't you busy? You have a practice with hundreds of patients. You know, why not me? Let me look at it. And so that's what launched that journey of advocacy for liberating the data. Today, the problem, as surprising as it might be, it still persists. And there are no APIs to connect the data. We have a lot of challenges that still before us as we head into this world of more generative AI and predictive AI in the hands of folks like patients. Because we really need to understand, patients do need to understand how to go about collecting the data, where the data resides, how to parse the data, what data might be relevant, the data is still not available. It's still difficult to access. And nowadays, there's even a newer hurdle, which I've recently written about on my Medium and on LinkedIn about this, got a lot of attention. And the new hurdle is the fact that folks don't have printers anymore. Before, I would go into the clinic and say, I want a copy of this report because I know this report will not be made a part of my electronic health record. So can you print a copy of this for me? And most of the times, folks, especially if they knew me and how important that was to me, they would print it. And but nowadays, there are no printers. And so they say no. So in fact, the problem has become even worse. It's obscurity and lack of transparency and bureaucracy all put it into this. It's a whole new situation. And I, again, to bring it back and finally to AI, I think AI in the hands of patients who use it to help them think, not to help give them answers, it can be a very powerful tool in order to push back on some of these barriers and in a way that can be very compelling.
I think your example, Liz, from Open Notes really is so familiar for what we're seeing right now with AI, where there's a lot of concern about whether patients will make bad decisions or jump ahead of the clinician. And I always point out when we have these conversations, you can't operate on yourself. You can't prescribe a med to yourself. So ultimately, there's still going to have to be a clinician in the mix for those kinds of decisions. But I think that those concerns really mirror what we saw in Open Notes. But there are also concerns about how the data are going to get used. Somebody pointed out that the person in charge of ChatGPT Health was the person who figured out how to make Instagram really viral and really contagious, right? And so I think that might be okay with health information, but I don't even know what that could look like if we're like on our ChatGPT Health 7 hours a day, as I seem to be on my phone. And then concerns about just overall protections and risks. So in this policy space, and I think it's such a fast-moving space, I always am wary of people that say, here's the policy solution. But I'm just curious about whether there are domains of policymaking where you really hope either the states or the feds will step up and what that would look like right now.
I mean, it's interesting that you bring up the person from ChatGPT Health being involved in Instagram. I didn't necessarily know that. But one of the things I notice as a user is, well, of social media is they want to make things sticky. And like if you scroll across a certain type of post on, I'll say, Instagram, I like cats. And I am fed so many cat videos because it's clear that their algorithm has figured out that I love cat stuff or, you know, pictures of beautiful food, something like that. And one of the things that I feel has been missing in healthcare is how to make my health information sticky. Of course, I'm an Open Notes person. I love reading my notes. I read every single doctor's notes. And I read them again before my next visit just to remind me about what was said at the last visit. And because I am a person that has all of my health records from my first brain cancer diagnosis in 2008, I have read every single note. And I find so much cool stuff in there. Even my first emergency department visit because I had a massive grand mal seizure, they say something really interesting in there that was funny, that is meaningful to me. Like what these ED docs said 18 years ago still resonates with me. And I find it sticky because I can read, like, someone else is commenting on my experience when I was unconscious and I want to know. You know, I am that curious person. So I wish there was a way to take that stickiness that we might start seeing with these AI tools. The AI tools make it, they're conversational. You want to engage with them. They talk like you. And the more you use those tools, the more they reflect back how you talk to them.
Yeah, you know, in terms of policy, for me, I think we may have to rethink how we approach privacy. And, you know, personally, I have a relatively loose attitude about privacy with my medical records. I usually upload them to different apps. I don't really have a problem with it. But if there were something that I would find embarrassed about it, I probably would have a slightly different attitude. So we must think about ways in which people can protect things. And it may be that HIPAA falls short and the 21st Century Cures Act might fall short and others. And we may have to come up with new ways of finding mechanisms for people to protect their information. But I tell you, when regards my financial information, for example, I was in the Equifax breach of millions of records. So my social security number, even in spite of all the effort that I've made over the years to keep my financial information protected, it is on the dark web. And it's nothing that I did wrong about it. And so sometimes, in spite of all the lengths that you go to protect, to keep your information private, somebody else who is actually entrusted with that information and are professionals, and they are the ones who compromise it.
So I'm in a lot of patient communities. I still, you know, different social media platforms, staying connected. And I've been in a lot of brain tumor or brain cancer communities on Facebook. There's a lot of groups for patients who are trying to navigate their health system. And one of the things I find really interesting is when somebody's diagnosed with something serious, people who are newly diagnosed will go and take a picture with their photo. They're not even taking a screenshot. They're taking a picture of their brain MRI on the doctor's computer. And they take that picture and then they'll post it on a Facebook group where no medical records are redacted. Like, they didn't think about that, but I can see it right there. And then they ask the community, I just been diagnosed with this, or my mother has been diagnosed with this, and this is what it's called. Have any of you been diagnosed with that? Tell me more. Where should I go for information? Or give me some hope that there are some survivors out there. I see that every day, multiple times a day. And then there'll be 50 comments from people who want to help that person because they've had that same experience. And so from a privacy perspective, if you are sick and worried, privacy goes out the window. But clinicians and health systems, they're not in those spaces. They don't even play in those spaces. It's patient voices that help the other patient voices. And I think one of the things clinicians are concerned about is, are those 50 comments, are they, you know, correct? Are they giving bad information? Are they turning them to misinformation? But what I find interesting is maybe there's one or two comments in there that are kind of sketchy, but the community tends to provide like really good advice because they've had real experiences and they want to help. So for clinicians who don't play in those spaces, one of the things I could say is actually the community, you know, good stuff rises to the top.
I remember when my kid was in fifth grade, the teachers banned them from using Wikipedia. We are so mad about it. And then there are all these studies that show, you know, the information. Yeah, sure, there's some inaccurate stuff, but it gets corrected, or the community itself will kind of manage the information.
The community.
Yeah.
I feel like I have to defend the, this is going back to the previous conversation when you mentioned the LinkedIn comment or somebody who said, the person head of OpenAI GPT Health is somebody who comes from Instagram. Maybe they will solve the problem of engagement with health information in a way that nobody's ever solved. So I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing.
The cat video of health information, essentially.
Right. Sign me up.
If you could give the developers of these tools one piece of advice, what would it be? And I'll go to Liz first and then Hugo.
One piece of advice is hire a patient or patients as part of your team that are not just technologists who later became patients. Hire a Hugo. Like, why haven't you made a job offer to a Hugo for your health team? Like, real people who found health security flaws, have those real people who lived through it before they got their bachelor's degree in computer science and ultimately started working in AI. I would love to see it go the other way.
I don't know that I have any bright advice for anybody. I'm excited about the direction we've been going. I hope that we can continue advancing in this direction in a way that really gives people agency over ourselves. Where, you know, developers are also at some point in their lives will be either caring for a family member who might be ill, or might, God forbid, might have to deal with a challenging health problem themselves as we all age and things creep up. We're all doing this for ourselves, and it's important to have voice, and it's important to have agency in the health decisions that shape our lives. And so I think it's important for developers to not lose sight of why this matters. And I think at the core of it, it's about agency, and it's about giving people the options and the ability to make better informed decisions about their health and their healthcare.
Well, that's a great note to end on from both of you. Thank you so much for joining.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Years ago, I had an interesting conversation with a wise doctor friend. He told me about a patient who arrived at her first oncology appointment with him, shopping bags filled with research articles. She had read every single one, and he had not. His first reaction was immediate and human. He's the doctor. He's supposed to be the expert. And in that moment, he felt his authority was being challenged. But instead of getting defensive, he paused. He took a deep breath and asked her, "Okay, what role do you want me to play?" Patients now walk into exam rooms having read studies, connected with others online, and increasingly, having used AI to summarize research, generate questions, and interpret their own data. That doesn't make doctors irrelevant. It makes the relationship different. So the real question isn't whether patients will use these tools. They are. The question is whether healthcare will meet them there. Will we tighten our grip on authority? Or will we ask, like my friend did, what is my new role now? This podcast was created by me, Claudia Williams. My podcast producer is Avery Moore-Kloss. Check out the show notes for more information on Hugo Campos, Liz Selmy, and their work. There is more information on my background, this podcast, and our guests on our website, www.theother80.com. Until next time, I'm Claudia Williams.